I want to begin with today, just show you some, really, they're animal pictures that I found on the internet. And I've got a point to all this, but there's a couple of dogs and there's some elephants. You can see them sitting there. This is not the way elephants usually sit, but these are circus elephants. They're sitting on chairs and here or there. You know, they're elephant tamers, I guess you'd call them, and they're directing these elephants to do what they want them to do. And dogs are really very similar. You can control dogs and you can teach them to do kind of whatever you want them to do within the limitations of being a dog, I guess. They can catch frisbees and they can do the agility training, and you can train a dog to help a blind person and serve people in other ways and things like that. So you can make a dog do all kinds of things. You can train him and bring him under your control if he will. Now, we have a dog, and he has us trained. And he goes to the door and whimpers a little bit, and we jump right up and run to the door, and I know what he's thinking. I've got them trained. All I got to do is whimper a little bit, and then they jump. And so he has us trained. But anyway, you can train dogs to do lots of things. Here are these elephants again. Here's a tiger. Tigers don't usually jump through hoops of fire, but this one has been taught to do that, and he's under the control of his tamer, and he'll do what the tamer has taught him to do. And I think this is a killer whale. You can see right here, this is from SeaWorld. You can see that. And this just shows you all kinds of animals. All kinds of animals have been tamed. There's these elephants, and then there are tigers, and then even these sea creatures, dogs have been tamed as well. When I was a boy, I used to watch Tarzan movies. And if you don't know who Tarzan was, he was he apparently had been a boy growing up sort of independently without mother or father in the jungle, or we call it the rainforest today. But sort of grew up and among the wild animals, and he was able to do all kinds of things. He'd swing through the trees on these vines and stuff like that. If he ever got into trouble, he would just call, you know, his Tarzan call, and just herds of elephants and lions and antelope and water buffalo would come to his rescue. And so all of those animals were under Tarzan's control. Tarzan had a wife. I'm not exactly sure how he got her, but her name was Jane, of course, Tarzan and Jane. And they had a son. His name, of course, was Boy. You know, what else would you call a son? His name was Boy. And then they had a pet chimp. And of course, his name was Cheetah. What else would you call a chimp? He's a cheetah. And he looked kind of like this, and Cheetah could do all kinds of things. And not Cheetah, but the chimp that played Cheetah. They had trained him to do all sorts of things. And so you got all these animals, all these beasts, we might say, that have come under the control, or men have been able to put these animals under their control, and they can be taught to do all sorts of things. They can be controlled in all sorts of ways. But there's one beast that James tells us we can't tame, and that's the tongue. I don't really want to talk about the animals today, and I hope that really doesn't detract from the lesson. Just illustrates the point that James makes. In fact, James says, every species of beast and birds, of reptiles and creatures of the sea, is tamed and has been tamed by the human race, but no one can tame the tongue. And so all these pictures really just serve as an illustration of the point that James has made. All these animals have been tamed, but no one can tame the tongue. All right? And so that's really what I want to talk about today. In James chapter 3, James makes four points about the tongue. And we're going to talk about those four points in just a moment. We're going to introduce our discussion today by making a few observations. First of all, there are many ways to sin with the tongue. There are lots of ways to sin with our ability to speak. You know, speaking is a uniquely human ability. You know, some people say, well, you know, animals have been taught to speak. Well, maybe in a very elementary way or very rudimentary way, an animal has been taught how to communicate or recognize certain symbols or signs. But as someone has observed, you know, the very top of an animal's ability in this area is the very bottom of a human ability. And so what, you know, the anyway, that just ability to communicate through speech is, I think, uniquely human. And there are lots of ways to use it for good, but there are lots of ways to use it for evil. Here are just a few ways. We can lie. We can gossip. We can use God's name inappropriately or use God's name in vain. We can complain and murmur. We can insult others. We can slander. We can teach falsely. There may be others. You might be able to think of other ways that we can sin with our ability to speak, the ability that God gave us to do good and to accomplish good, to edify and build up. And yet we pervert it and distort it, and we use it often for evil. In fact, that's so common that James makes the point. No one can fully tame the tongue. Now, we might hope to control it, but none of us can control it altogether. The second observation I would make is that the standard for acceptable language in society has been in steady decline over recent years. And so what is acceptable, what is accepted as this is appropriate speech or at least tolerable speech, that has been in decline for a number of years. That's just my observation, I suppose. Profane and obscene language is widely used without any apology at all. And so people use profanity and obscenity. It doesn't bother them, and they assume that it doesn't bother you, and men and women alike. I guess when I was growing up, it was considered just bad form, I suppose you would say. Just not appropriate for a woman to use profanity. But now, you know, it's just considered unladylike. But that was a time when women were interested in being ladies, you know. Now I'm not so sure that women in general are all that concerned about being ladies. They want to be more like men in some ways, and they want to be able to curse like a man. And so it's not unusual to find men and women alike just using all sorts of profane language. Crude language, if it's not considered profanity or obscenity, just crude language and crude subject matter is common today. Whereas a few years ago, or at least a generation ago, is completely unacceptable. Even respected news outlets like Newsweek magazine or Time magazine or Sports Illustrated, those are the magazines that we get in our house. They've begun, what I've noticed is that even they have begun to use profane language, not in the articles, but in the titles to the articles. Or even on the cover of the magazine. If not actual profanity itself, at least the suggestion. And so they'll maybe give the first letter of a word or maybe ellipsis or fill in the blank. And really they're suggesting, you know, it should be filled in or some sort of profane language should be supplied. And I think that's a relatively new thing. And so even though this language might be considered mild profanity in some circles, it seems to me that it runs counter to the standard of operating as dignified journalists at a dignified journalistic level. You know, here's a dignified journalist. Well, why would he use that sort of common gutter language? You know, there's a certain standard, really, that here's somebody that uses language as his primary tool. This is the primary tool of his work. And he should be able to make his point without resorting to the lowest forms of language. Anyway, I think that's a relatively new development. I always heard that profanity is the lazy man's way to make a point. I think there's a lot of truth to that. It certainly is not very creative, is it? So just a lazy man's way to make his point. We can do something better than that. And I wish that somebody would tell comedians that just because you use profanity doesn't mean your jokes are funny. You know, so here's a comedian, he's telling a joke that is, or story, it's not funny in the least, but he sprinkles in a few profanities and all of a sudden the audience laughs. Well, you know, that shouldn't be. Makes me wonder why people in our culture aspire to the basest elements of our nature. Why is it that we aspire to the lowest elements of our nature? Why is it that our heroes are criminals? Or the promiscuous, or the profane? Why do we ridicule the virtuous and holy and make the trashiest people the biggest stars? You ever wonder that? Why do we make the trashiest people the biggest stars? Why do we aspire to the basis, to the lowest elements of our culture? Why not aspire to holiness and refinement in speech? Remember what Paul says in Philippians chapter 4. You know, whatever is good and holy and virtuous, you know, think on those things. Verse 8. Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right and pure, whatever is lovely and is of good report, if there is any excellence, anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. And so that's the standard for Christians, things that are holy and righteous and pure and of good repute. But that's not our culture, is it? In the book of Ephesians, chapter 5 and verse 4, there Paul says, there must be no filthiness and silly talk or coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. A little bit earlier he'll say, let no unwholesome word proceed out of your mouth. And so there are lots of ways to sin with our tongue. Let's not get caught up in the decline that we see in our culture and the acceptable, you know, what is accepted as appropriate language and subject matter. We are to aspire to what is holy and good and right and good report. Now, with all that in mind, go over to James chapter 3 and let's talk a little bit of what James has to say. The first thing he says is that though small, the tongue is capable of big things. In verse 2, he says, we all stumble in many ways. If anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man. The idea is there, he's reached a stage of full growth. He's a mature Christian, a mature man in the sight of God. And so he's a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body as well. Now, if we put the bits into the horse's mouth so that they will obey us and we direct their entire body as well, he says, look at the ships also, though they are so great and driven by strong winds, are still directed by a very small rudder wherever the inclination of the pilot desires. So also is the tongue, a small part of the body, and yet it boasts of great things. See how great a forest is set aflame by such a small fire. And so the first point he makes is this, that though the tongue is small, a small part of the body, it's able to accomplish big things or great things. And he uses three illustrations. A bit. It's just a small instrument, just a small piece of equipment. But you put it in a horse's mouth. I don't know anything about all this, really. I've seen it done, of course. And then a skilled horseman can direct that whole horse. Horse is a big animal. But it can be controlled with just a little bit. A rudder compared to the ship is a small part of the ship, and yet it's able to guide the entire ship through the water. A very small fire, at least what starts as a small fire, can consume a great forest. We see that every year out west, especially with the forest fire problems that they have. And all of that is similar to the tongue, a small part of the body, but is able to accomplish great things. And really, it just illustrates the deceptive nature of the tongue. Don't be deceived. The tongue is just a small thing, but don't be deceived. It's capable of doing big things, both positive and negative. We've all been moved by the spoken word. We know how powerful the spoken word can be. We've heard great speeches or we've heard great sermons. And then, you know, great political sermons are given, or great political speeches are given to win votes. And so a person here is a great politician, an orator, and just by the strength of his oratory, he said, I'm going to vote for him. You know, he's swept by the power of his speech. Athletes hear great motivational speeches, and they go out, and they win the game. We might hear a patriotic speech, and a nation is built. Or we might hear an effective sermon, and sinners are saved. So the tongue is able to accomplish great things, but the tongue can be used as an instrument of destruction as well. So that's the next point that James makes. Down in verse 5 he says, see how great a forest is set aflame by such a small fire. Now the first two illustrations are sort of neutral. A bit in a horse's mouth, a rudder on a ship. But now he's moved into using an illustration that it's destructive in its force. A fire consuming a forest or destroying a forest. And that allows him to move on into making another point about the tongue. And the tongue is a fire. And listen to what he says about the tongue. The very world of iniquity. The tongue is set among our members as that which defiles the entire body and sets on fire the course of our life and is set on fire by hell. So now he talks a little bit about the danger of the tongue and how it might be used as a powerful instrument of destruction. And notice what his descriptions here. The very world of iniquity. One writer observed that there are few sins committed without words being involved at some point. And that may be true. It encompasses every aspect of life and activity in the world. Few sins committed without words being involved at some point. It's the world of iniquity. It's a part of us that defiles the entire body. There's no part of our body that can't be talked into doing something wrong by the tongue, so to speak. And so it defiles our whole body. And then he says that it sets on fire the course of our life. The word course is the word for wheel. It's the wheel of life or the wheel of birth or the wheel of nature. The whole of life from birth, the wheel which then begins to roll on its course and continues rolling unto death. And so the whole idea is that our whole life from the time we're small until the time we're old and we pass, the whole life, all of life is affected by the tongue. Can be built up and encouraged by it, but can be destroyed by it as well. And then finally he says that the tongue is set on fire by hell. You remember in Jesus' conversation with some of those who are criticizing him in John chapter 8, in verse 44, he talks about the devil. He says, it's your father, the devil. Whenever he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own nature, for he's a liar and the father of lies. And so, the very source of evil that's accomplished through the tongue is hell itself. It's the devil itself. And so think a little bit about the destructive nature of speech. Consider what has been destroyed because of things that have been said. Just think about that. Think about all the things that have been ruined or destroyed or damaged because of what someone has said. We'll mention a few. A child's emotional well-being. We've seen children whose father or mother constantly complains and complains about him and just yells at him and just gets him down on the ground and just drives him right down into the dirt by what's said. And so that's the destructive nature of the tongue. For that matter, an adult's emotional well-being. Maybe a wife or maybe a husband is the victim of their spouse just continually berating and criticizing. And it just wears them down and wears them down. Friendships have been destroyed. Marriages destroyed. A person's physical well-being might well be destroyed by what he says. He's provoked by what someone says, or he provokes someone by what he says. They end up getting in a fight, and his physical well-being is destroyed. Nations go to war because of threatening language. And then, maybe worst of all, churches are destroyed because of what people say to each other. You ever seen that situation where because of what somebody has said, maybe in anger, or maybe frustration, maybe jealousy or envy, a church is destroyed through what is said. Sometimes we say, sticks and stones may break my bones. I remember being told that when I was a child. Just remember, Bob, sticks and stones. Just tell yourself, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never harm me. It's not true, is it? That's not true. Words do harm us. Words do hurt. And so our tongue, the words we say with our tongue, can be a force, a powerful force for destruction. No wonder James says that the tongue is set on fire by hell. Of course, Satan rejoices at the destruction brought on by what is said. He rejoices in the lying and the gossip and the insults and the words said in anger and the hurtful comments and the threats and the name calling. He loves it. He rejoices in all that, and he rejoices in the harm that's done by it as well. And so no wonder James says that the tongue is set on fire by hell. He goes on then to say that no one can tame the tongue. You see that in verse 7. For every species of beasts and birds, of reptiles and creatures of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by the human race. but no one can tame the tongue. And then he adds two more descriptions. It is a restless evil and full of deadly poison. And so if the previous four descriptions were not enough, he adds two more. A restless evil full of deadly poison. The tongue is restless. It's continually seeking opportunities to express itself, whether it's appropriate to do so or not. And of course, this gets us into trouble. We just can't keep our mouths shut sometimes, can we? And so it gets us into trouble. See, the tongue is a restless evil. The Proverbs say, Proverbs 10 and verse 19, when there are many words, transgression is unavoidable. But he who restrains his lips is wise. Where there is many words, transgression is unavoidable. James would say earlier in his book, James chapter 1, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak. Swift to hear, slow to speak. I remember when I was a kid, I was told, that's why God gave you two ears and one mouth. Swift to hear, slow to speak. Listen twice as much as you talk. I didn't always pay attention to that, but that's good advice. We'll say sometimes, well, I just spoke before I thought. Of course, that's not true, is it? We always think before we speak. We formulate the words in our minds before they come out of our mouth. We might mean I didn't think long enough before I thought. But it does speak to the point that our tongue is restless. It's overactive. Before you know it, it blurts out something that really we should have kept to ourselves. We'll speak before we give ourselves enough time to think. And so again, James says, let every man be slow to speak. The Proverbs say, again, Proverbs 17, verse 27, he who restrains his words has knowledge, and he who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. So let's restrain our words and, you know, be a knowledgeable person. Peter provides a good illustration of this point. Being swift to hear, not being swift to speak, not being able to tame the tongue. I can think of at least three occasions where Peter should have given himself more time to think before he blurted something out. One was on the Mount of Transfiguration when he says, it's good for us to be here. Let's build three tabernacles, one for Moses, one for Elijah, one for Christ. That prompted God to respond, this is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. Hear him. Hear him. On another occasion, Peter says, well, even though everybody forsakes you, I'll never forsake you. And of course, the Lord says, Peter, before the night's over, you're going to deny me three times. See how quick he is to speak. He needs to be thinking instead of speaking. And then he finds himself in the courtyard with the opponents of Jesus. And when the pressure is put on him, you're one of his disciples, aren't you? But he said, no, I don't even know him. And even began to curse and swear, I don't know the man. And so not even Peter was able to tame the tongue. There are times when he should have been thinking instead of speaking, but he spoke instead of thought. How often have disagreements or small nuisances become arguments, and then arguments become fights because people just didn't control their tongue? Again, Proverbs 15 verse 1 says, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. We must learn to control what we say, otherwise we're going to bring hardship on ourselves. And even though we may not be able to tame the tongue, maybe we can control it, bring it under our control. Just think before we speak. That'll go a long way in helping us accomplish this. And then the last thing that James says is that what we say reveals the nature of our hearts. Look at verse 9. With it we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come both blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be this way. Does a fountain send out from the same opening both fresh and bitter water? Can a fig tree, my brethren, produce olives, or a vine produce figs? Nor can salt water produce fresh. And so, what he's saying is, in a sense, I think, the same thing that Jesus says over in the book of Matthew, chapter 15, verses 15 through 20, where Jesus ultimately says in verse 18, the things that proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and those defile the man. It's not what a man eats, not what he puts into his mouth, it's what comes out of his mouth that defiles him, because that comes from the heart. So his words reveal what is in his heart. If his heart is impure, well, then impure speech is going to come out. If his heart is good and pure, well, then that's going to be revealed by his speech as well. Similar point is made in Matthew chapter 12 and verse 33. Either make the tree good and its fruit good, or make the tree bad and its fruit bad, for the tree is known by its fruit. You brood of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak what is good? For the mouth speaks out of that which fills the heart. The good man brings out of his good treasure what is good, and the evil man brings out of his evil treasure what is evil. But I tell you that every careless word that people speak, they will give an accounting for it in the day of judgment. For by your words you'll be justified, and by your words you'll be condemned. And so, if good things are in our heart, good things will be spoken. If we're speaking bad things, it means that our heart is not what it ought to be. You know, don't be deceived. And we like to think, well, everybody's a pretty good guy. He's a pretty good guy. I know that he can't go one sentence without using profanity, but his heart is good. I know that he uses God's name in vain every other sentence, you know, but he's got a good heart. I know sometimes his jokes are filthy and crude, and all, but you know, his heart is good. Now, if evil communication is coming out of our mouth, it's because there's evil in our heart. That's what Jesus said. Because out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And so maybe the solution to our problems with our tongue and our speech, we need to work on our hearts, and then the speech will take care of itself. I think one of the best ways to make an impression on a person for good is by what we say. If we avoid profanity, if we don't lie, if we avoid joking in an inappropriate way, a way that's inappropriate for Christians, if we avoid gossip, it's not going to be long before people see that in us. And they're going to say, he's different. He didn't talk like the rest of us. He didn't tell the same jokes that we tell. He doesn't gossip like we do. He's different. But what is there that's different about him? Oh, he's a Christian. And so one of the, I think, the best ways to make an impression on people for good is by controlling our tongue and not allowing any unwholesome speech to proceed out of our mouth, but such as is good for edifying, what will build up, not what will tear down. And so let's make that our goal, that today, tomorrow, throughout the week and next week, we're going to raise the standard. We're going to raise our own standard to make it conform to what God would have us to be in word and thought and deed. If you're here today and not a Christian, we want to give you an opportunity to respond to the invitation to make the confession. See, that's something we can do with our ability to speak. We can make the confession that Jesus is Lord and Christ, the Son of God, our Savior. If you'll confess that, if you believe it in your heart, you'll confess it. If you'll repent of your sins and be baptized, you can be a Christian today. You can begin a life of faithful service to the Lord. Maybe you've begun that in the past, but your life is not what it ought to be. Maybe in this very area you've fallen short and you need to make some corrections. Well, we want to encourage you to do that today. If we can help you in some way, we invite you to come. We stand and sing together.